Hello, this is Bob.
Now,
by the time you hear this, I will have had throat surgery, which, as I record this, is scheduled for the very end of June. So I'm not going to be recording any new podcasts for the next week or two. However, so vast and deep are our archives that I have any number of golden oldies to choose from in filling this void. Today's offering is a conversation on consciousness with the philosopher possibly most famously associated with the question of consciousness, David Chalmers. He formulated this phrase, the hard problem of consciousness. This is from 2016. That's 9 years ago. And believe it or not, we've still not solved the mind-body problem. In fact, I don't know that radical progress has been made. So this is as relevant as it ever would be. So this is as relevant as ever, and I hope you like it. And I will be back in a couple of weeks. Now, in the meanwhile, please, although I will be suffering from excruciating post-surgical pain, do not waste any time feeling sorry for me, unless that feeling compels you to go to, say, the Apple Podcast site, Spotify, the podcast app of your choice, and leave a possibly favorable review for the Non-Zero Podcast and give it 5, 10, 50 stars, whatever you feel like. But that's optional. In any event, I will be back soon.
Hi, David.
Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good.
Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on streaming video and audio podcast. You're David Chalmers, very well-known philosopher at New York University. You may still have an affiliation in Australia, do you? Are you?
Yep, I'm 20% at the Australian National University.
20% of you is there even as we speak?
It tends to be the middle of the year, around June.
I see. Okay. So, and you're also the author of a number of books, The Conscious Mind, The Character of Consciousness is the second one, and Constructing the World is the most recent, all published by Oxford University Press. And, you know, you're very prominently associated with what we're going to talk about today, the study of consciousness, the mind-body problem. I would say if you did a poll of philosophers asking them to name colleagues who work on this, your name would appear on probably in the top, in the number one spot on a lot of lists. And so thanks for taking the time. Now, we are going to tackle the question of what consciousness is for. And I think we're willing to promise at the outset that we will have the problem completely solved by the end of the conversation, right?
No worries. We have an hour?
That's sure. More than enough. Sure. In fact, we'll have time left over. We can talk about the World Series or something.
Yep.
And let me say, I have kind of a wacky theory about what consciousness might be for, which would have radical implications for how we think about the meaning of life. You have been working lately on a theory that's been around for a while that's considered wacky in some corners. Is it grows out of quantum physics, and it would have very radical implications for how we perceive our relationship to reality, how we think about that. And so, but first we should set the problem up. And let me just, first of all, get a little clear on definitions. I think you and I both, when we speak of consciousness, are just talking about subjective experience in a broad sense. I mean, some people define consciousness in a way that's inherently specific to the human species. It's like self-awareness or something. But this is just the fact that, like, when my dog wags its tail, I think it's feeling something. Or when it seems that it's been injured, I think it's feeling pain. So it's something that any animal could in principle feel. We don't know for sure, but it's just kind of the fact that it's like to be something to be alive, as Thomas Nagel put it, right?
Yeah, basically, you know, it's like something to be me. It's like something to feel pain, or to see the color red. These all have an associated quality of subjective experience and needn't be anything terribly complicated. Any system which is actually feeling pain will be conscious in this sense. You're conscious if it feels like something from the inside. I mean, Tom Nagel talked about what is it like to be a bat? Well, we don't know, but as long as it's like something to be a bat, then the bat is conscious. Philosophers sometimes talk about phenomenal consciousness, it's a technical term that just means it kind of appears like something to you. to kind of capture the distinctive sense of consciousness and to distinguish it from self-consciousness, consciousness of yourself, which is probably something a lot more complicated, limited to humans and perhaps a few other species, and other kinds of, you know, behaviorally defined consciousness. What matters for the kind of consciousness we're talking about today is just the experience.
Mm-hmm. My own wacky theory may get us into the subject of self-consciousness, but we'll come to that later. Now, if people were to ask, well, why is it a mystery what consciousness is for? I guess we should say that on some views of consciousness, it's not so mysterious. So like if you look at the way Descartes looked at consciousness, that's called interactive dualism, meaning, you know, dualistic in the sense that this consciousness is in some sense separate from the body. And the interactive part means that, you know, on the one hand, the body influences consciousness. But on the other hand, according to Descartes, consciousness influences the body. That's the interaction. It goes both ways. And if that's the case, it's no great mystery. Then consciousness is integral to the functioning of the body. It's there to help the body work, right?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, to even pose the question, what is consciousness for, it helps to talk a little about a prior question, which is, how can we explain why does consciousness exist at all? And can we, for example, explain it in terms of processes in the brain? You might think, okay, well, we can explain everything about the mind straightforwardly in terms of the brain, so why not consciousness too? The trouble is, while that works pretty well for aspects of the mind which are tied very deeply to behavior, to doing stuff, to responding, to use of language, and so on, it's very unclear how that works for explaining subjective experience itself. It seems that you could explain all the stuff that I do, how I, for example, walk around, how I respond to your questions, and it still seems a bit of a mystery why all of that should be accompanied by a first-person perspective, something that feels like something from the inside when I'm experiencing this conversation. So various people, including me, have argued there's in fact a principled limitation there, and you're not going to explain everything about consciousness in terms of processes in the brain. And, you know, I've at least entertained the idea that it's something non-physical, but that raises the question of what it is that consciousness does all the more strongly. How could something non-physical play a role in the physical world? Descartes thought consciousness was non-physical, but he actually gave it a role in the physical world, saying there's a non-physical consciousness affects your brain via the pineal gland, and that goes on to affect behavior. And in fact, consciousness might be directly causally responsible for things like our use of language and our sophisticated reasoning.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, when I'm trying to explain to people why I think it's not clear what consciousness is for, I say a couple of things that I think are consistent with what you just said. One is, well, look, first of all, it increasingly looks like we could, in principle, build a machine that would do stuff as complicated as what humans do, and everything about the machine would be explicable in physical terms. We would understand, like, okay, we programmed this physical information, and information does assume physical incarnation in computer code, and in fact, it has all its effects physically, and you can trace them as they flow through the robot and so on. So, first of all, it just seems like in principle, you know, and of course, for all we know, it does feel like something to be the robot, but the point is we can explain all the robot's behavior without making that claim. Or to put it and let me ask you this. I think that, let me give you another example. If you ask the average kind of behavioral scientist, like maybe a neurologist or something, to explain what's going on when I accidentally put my hand near a flame and then withdraw it because of the pain, they will give me an answer in physical terms, right? I mean, they'll say, well, you've got these nerve endings and they send this physical information up and it has this physical effect and that leads to this reflex action and so on. So, you know, although behavioral scientists, I think, often don't think about the problem of consciousness, I think if you look at the way they talk and set about explaining our behavior, implied in the way they talk is the idea that it's not clear that consciousness has a role, that subjective experience has a role in actually doing anything, right? Isn't that kind of implied assumption in the behavioral sciences?
It certainly looks that as if most of the explanations which are given, at least at a low level, in the cognitive and behavioral sciences don't seem to mention consciousness. And it sure is starting to look as if most of what we can explain can be explained without any kind of explicit mention of consciousness. Now, to be fair, so far we can't explain so much in the behavioral sciences. We certainly can't explain everything. So you might say, well, maybe there'll still be a role for it. But it looks like, in principle, we're moving towards certainly a vision where everything we do can be explained in terms of, say, neural firings or computational processes in the brain. And then there's a real question, well, where does consciousness get in? Now, if you're inclined to think consciousness is just some neural process or other, or some computational process or other, then you might not be as worried about this. You say, oh, it's just another emergent high-level phenomenon like life. And it's the same that biologists don't mention life when they when they explain stuff in terms of DNA, but it's not as if life doesn't play any role. It's just, you know, it's a kind of a phenomenon of complexity. But for many of us, consciousness poses, you know, has a kind of special status that goes beyond the status of life. And it's very hard to see how it's reducible to a brain process or a computational process. And if you're not willing to be that kind of reductionist about consciousness, then it's harder just to take the line of, ah, it's just a high-level neural or computational process. And then it really does raise the question, what is consciousness actually doing?
Okay. So one common view, well, I don't know how common it is, but let's talk a little about epiphenomenalism, which is more or less what I had in mind when I was describing the view that's implied by the behavioral sciences. I mean, I think most behavioral scientists would say, sure, what's going on in the body influences consciousness. Those nerve endings that sensed the pain are what led to the feeling of pain. It's just that feelings don't in turn feed back into the physical system. So if you're conceiving of consciousness in a kind of dualistic sense as something that's kind of a little in some sense different from the physical stuff, then you are, you know, acknowledging one way influence from body to consciousness. And that view, right, correct me if I'm wrong, but that view is known as epiphenomenalism. So subjective experience is an epiphenomenon of the physical being. It is influenced by that being, but it doesn't in turn influence the physical body. So consciousness is kind of like the relationship of a shadow to my hand, if my hand is casting a shadow, right? The movement of my hand influences the shadow. Doesn't work the other way around.
Yeah, or the train and the steam engine and the steam whistle are another classic example. The workings of the engine causes the whistle. Every time the train is going, you get the whistle, but the whistle isn't actually doing anything. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and in philosophy, I mean, epiphenomenalism is a version, you know, of the view known as dualism, where the physical and the mental are distinct domains, as opposed to materialism, where you say, well, the mental, you know, consciousness is ultimately something physical. But the moment you've got dualism on the table, where there's the physical and the mental, there's a question, what does the mental actually do? Epiphenomenalism says the physical exerts a causal effect on the mental,
right,
but not vice versa. The other view, interactionism, says the physical exerts a causal effect on the mental, and the mental feeds back and affects the physical. But the epiphenomenalism says it's just one way.
Okay. Now I'm about to ask you a question that we shouldn't get sidetracked on for very long, because it's not essential to the path we're taking. But you mentioned this idea that consciousness just is the physical. Now, to my way of thinking, that's tantamount to saying consciousness doesn't exist. But it may be more subtle than that. I know that when I accuse Dan Dennett of believing that consciousness doesn't exist, he gets really upset because he says he's saying something other than that. But what he's saying, if it's other than that, is not intelligible to me, okay? So when you say there's the view that consciousness is the physical, in your mind, is that different from just saying, look, consciousness is kind of an illusion, the way kind of Gilbert Ryle, Dan Dennett's mentor, said in a kind of more explicitly?
Yeah, I think there's room. I mean, there's a big tangle of different philosophical views here. And there are certainly some people, and Dan Dennett is one, who once you look at their view in detail, it does seem to be denying or rejecting some aspects of the traditional conception of consciousness. But that said, there are a lot of people, both philosophers and scientists out there, who both want to say consciousness exists and it's perfectly real, and they want to say it's physical. It's a process in the brain. That's probably the most popular combination of views. That's like call it having your cake and eating it too, you know. You get to say consciousness exists because it seems undeniable from the first person point of view that it does. It just seems so real. Anyone who, like Dan, flirts with denying it is generally regarded as saying something extremely counterintuitive and maybe inconsistent with just the data we have from our own experience. So it's very attractive to say consciousness exists. It's also very attractive to say it's just a process in the brain. So any number of people have tried to do both those things. The trouble is, it's just very hard to make that view work. Because to actually acknowledge the reality of consciousness, how on earth could you explain it wholly in terms of processes in the brain? It looks like all you get from processes in the brain are various behavioral effects and so on, which is great for explaining language or learning, not so great for explaining consciousness. But that said, I think at least as a philosophical view, we ought to acknowledge the possibility of someone saying consciousness is physical and it exists. The question is just, can they make it work? Okay. I don't think so.
Okay, so you and I are both closer to the, well, I'm agnostic, but I think I certainly find appealing a view that I think you find kind of naturally appealing, which is more or less epiphenomenal. Like consciousness deserves to be called something. It's something, but there's no reason to think it's influencing the body, in which case you're left with epiphenomenalism because clearly bodily experiences are influencing consciousness. Now, that leads to my wacky theory, which is that in ironically, there's a sense in which an epiphenomenal consciousness could have a function.
Why don't we say just for a moment on epiphenomenalism, okay, just before getting to the theories. And so I think epiphenomenalism is worth some attention to think both about both its upsides and its downsides.
Right.
I mean, the upside of epiphenomenalism, it gets to say consciousness is real, and it doesn't seem to, you know, interfere with physical science and right, neuroscience and cognitive science, which is doing a great job in their own right, right, of explaining behavior. So think of it as a scientifically respectable form of dualism. The downside is it just seems bizarre that consciousness does nothing at all. You know, here... it seems like such an important thing. It seems kind of bizarre that it played no role in behavior. Surely my pain, for example, makes some difference in my withdrawing my hand from the flame. Or maybe here we are talking about consciousness. Surely my consciousness is playing some causal role in that. So many people find the idea that consciousness plays no causal role completely. People often use the word repugnant,
right,
and counterintuitive. Now, I've tried, in some days I feel sympathetic with epiphenomenalism. I should say I don't have a fixed view about any of this. I mean, one view I'm kind of attracted to is, well, I think that consciousness needs to play a causal role, mm-hmm, in order to, you know, vindicate its existence in the world. I think, for example, consciousness is the most important phenomenon in the universe in its own right. It's what gives everything in our lives meaning and value. Mm-hmm. So the epiphenomenalist can say, well, you know, consciousness doesn't need to justify its existence by doing something else. Consciousness is itself the most important thing in existence. Everything else has to justify itself by its effects on consciousness. So that's a way of somehow reconciling
it. At the same time, A, there's nothing else that we know of in the universe that plays no role in the causal chain of physical events, right?
Yeah.
And B, as you said, it's what gives life meaning. I mean, if you imagine a planet full of beings that had no sentience, you wouldn't really care what happened to them because there would be no suffering or joy in any event, so there would be no real stake. So if, you know, if in fact the thing that gives life meaning was not essential, it's like an add-on, well, that I think not implausibly leads to speculation about higher purpose or something. It's like, well, what gave us this gift? I mean, I think you'd be not crazy to ask that question.
Yeah, but the evolutionary question would be a really important one. How did this thing ever come into existence? How did it get selected for? Sure. I think the epiphenomenalist needs to say somehow consciousness was fundamental to the universe all along, and it wasn't merely evolution that it came in.
We're heading toward my wacky theory, and you actually kind of led us there when you mentioned this. The fact that actually, right now, consciousness is influencing the physical world because you and I are talking about it.
Yeah.
And even if you're not talking about the mind-body problem, if you just say, I feel pain, or what you just said offended me, then it seems as if these feelings, the feeling of being offended, the feeling of pain, are having an effect on the physical world. Now, this figures in my wacky theory. But I before we get to that, I assume that it's been argued by some philosophers that this is the reductio ad absurdum of epiphenomenalism, right? It's like if consciousness exerts no causal influence on the physical world, there's no way beings could talk about it, because that is de facto consciousness influencing the physical world, right? Is that an argument that's made?
Yeah, that's a very common, maybe the single most common objection to epiphenomenalism. It's ridiculous to say that consciousness doesn't even cause the things we say about mm-hmm. consciousness. Now, in a book I wrote about 20 years ago, The Conscious Mind, I tried to at least give a limited defense of epiphenomenalism, and I tried to say, hey, this isn't so bad, but it is at least counterintuitive. You can imagine, for example, in some different universe without consciousness, there could be a purely physical being, what we philosophers like to call a zombie, who's physically like me but without consciousness. And there's my zombie twin slaving away, writing a book on consciousness and having this conversation over Skype about consciousness, all without actually having consciousness. To many people, that's very, very bizarre, that, that somehow it would suggest that in me, my consciousness is irrelevant to all of this going on, and that's at least bizarre. I tried to argue it wasn't so bizarre, but I gotta say, my success was only limited. A lot of people still think it's pretty bizarre, and I can see the intuition. So I think there's a lot to be said for looking for alternatives to epiphenomenalism, if you can do it.
So in the scenario you were envisioning to justify epiphenomenalism, you would have this planet where beings were just like us physically, but the sentience were just wasn't metaphysically built into this universe or this planet. And yet, when they reach self-awareness, they would say things like, I feel hot.
Yeah, well...
That does seem paradoxical.
Once they reach certain levels of intelligence, my zombie twin, zombie David Chalmers, writing his book called The Conscious Mind, all about, this magnificent phenomenon of consciousness and how hard it is to explain. But for him, there's no consciousness there at all. And that's... Mm-hmm. Okay, weird things go on, and this is just an alternative possible world. Mm-hmm. Weird things go on in possible worlds, so one shouldn't be too quick to make inferences that the theory is false from that. But the very idea that suggests that for me, my consciousness is playing no role in my right now discussing it, that is a little bizarre.
That is. And yet, if you try to imagine at a fine grain, by what mechanism is my subjective experience leading to a report of it, it's hard not to think of the subjective experience as influencing the physical world, which would then be not epiphenomenalism.
But at the same time, there's still the basic worry, how on earth could subjective experience influence my reports of it? So on the one hand, it's very intuitive to say consciousness causes the things I say about consciousness. But then there's also the basic problem, everything I say about consciousness seems to be caused by neural processes or computational processes, and in principle, one could probably spell out that whole story without mentioning consciousness. It still leaves open the question of how consciousness gets in there and makes a difference.
Okay.
Maybe you have a solution to that.
Maybe I do. Maybe I don't. But here's the wacky theory as the drum roll toward my unveiling it continues. I actually talked about it in a lecture that we can link to that I did at Union Theological Seminary in the spring. But So, in a way, what my scenario involves is the possibility that consciousness, subjective experience, is epiphenomenal, I guess, until animals achieve a human level of self-awareness and linguistic proficiency or something, at which point, one way or another, it starts leading to reports of it. I guess you have to grant that. So, it's a kind of a... if you want to say that our talking about consciousness or how we feel inside is consciousness influencing the world, I guess my scenario involves that kind of thing not being possible until you get to a particular point in evolution. I don't think it's easy to sketch that out in much detail, but it's I'll have to stipulate that. Okay, it's at least conceivable in a very vague sense. So anyway, here's the idea. And it involves the idea that evolution itself, the history of life on this planet itself, has a purpose in some sense. Now, I want to emphasize, this doesn't imply any spooky forces like, you know, like the intelligent design people talk about. We're talking about nuts and bolts, natural selection. And the premise is, actually, natural selection is fairly likely to eventually lead to intelligent life, which in turn is fairly likely to lead to a cultural evolution that then leads the species to eventually enmesh itself in technology and get to where we are. Here we are on the verge of this giant global brain. So it's a nuts and bolts process that got us here. It's not spooky in that sense, but in some sense or another, purpose was imparted to the process. And you can imagine a deistic god. You can imagine space aliens. You can even imagine a simple process of cosmic natural selection among universes leading to this. I won't get into that right now. But anyway, the idea is that, you know, once we start, if you view the purpose of the whole system as getting to higher and higher levels of organization, cell, multicellular life, social animals that are multicellular, and then eventually vast societies like we built, and eventually, we're, you know, possibly global organization that we seem to be on the verge of. The internet is like a kind of like a global brain. If you view that as being part of the process, here's what the argument would be, that as being part of the purpose, that our talking about our subjective experience plays a role in carrying organization to that, what is so far the final level, the global level. It plays a role in the congealing of social order. And certainly, people saying things like, wait a second, that hurt me when you said that, or when you did that. And the other person saying, well then, okay, I won't hurt you, but then you don't hurt me. This kind of discourse plays a role sometimes in social cohesion, right? And so you can imagine that, if indeed purpose, however, in whatever form, was imparted, you know, there's in some sense a larger purpose, if the term higher purpose freaks you out, a larger purpose unfolding through the workings of nature, then the function of consciousness, there's no function at the individual organism's level, but at the larger social level, the function of consciousness is to congeal social order and help sustain the overall trajectory toward higher and higher levels of organization. So that's the idea. Is that at least intelligible?
Yeah, I mean, I think I see the idea. I mean, one way of looking at it is you've at least given a potential function for talking about consciousness. Mm-hmm. Here is why you might expect that in certain groups, all this this belief that we are conscious and claims that we are conscious and claims to other people that you are conscious and so on could play an important social role in, for example, distinguishing us, the special conscious creatures, from others and isolating certain parts of the world as the loci of consciousness. Yeah, that could play some kind of role in special group identification, mm-hmm. and making us feel like we've got some special role in nature. I guess my worry would be, okay, this is a potentially convincing role for talking about consciousness. Mm-hmm. I still worry, why do you need consciousness for that? And what is the role that consciousness is playing here? I suppose consciousness could facilitate talking about consciousness. That is kind of plausible that it does, but it still leaves open the question of a mechanism. How on earth could consciousness be getting in, especially if consciousness is not something physical?
Right.
How on earth could it be actually getting in to the system and bringing about talking about consciousness?
Yeah, I think you almost have to think of it as an epiphenomenal consciousness that at some point just ceases to be epiphenomenal, again, by virtue of the nature of self-awareness or something, right? By virtue of the nature of a human level of self-awareness, that changes something. It's a kind of a latent influence and latent functionality. So in other words, throughout the history of life, there was no influence exerted by consciousness. Hence, it couldn't have a function.
But it was sitting around just waiting to play its role.
Look.
Manchurian candidate or something.
Triggered
for action.
But when you think about it, that is actually a feature of designed purposive systems. So, for example, human beings and many animals They have reproductive equipment long before it is put to use. There are various things in the human body that start showing up. And if you had only seen their history up to that point, you go, what the hell is that for? But later it has a purpose. So that's actually, so if you agree that, if you'll accept the stipulation that maybe just as natural selection imbued individual organisms with purpose, then maybe some meta-natural selection process imbued natural selection with purpose, or some god did, or some space alien did, then actually that part is very, very, that makes sense, that there would be latent functionality, features that exist before they have functional influence.
Well, in the usual cases, the features get selected in the first place by evolution because they had some other functionality, and this leads to one major worry, I take it, for your view, which is in some ways it shares some of the problems of epiphenomenalism, at least at the earlier stages of selection. If we want to say that that other primates and dogs and cats and fish have been conscious for all these years, there's at least a very strong question. What on earth is their consciousness doing, and how did their consciousness come to be selected? Well, and on the view you're outlining, I take it, well, maybe our consciousness is doing something, but their consciousness is not. Their consciousness is epiphenomenal, which you might think gives rise at least to many of the problems of epiphenomenalism, namely, how did that get selected, and how bizarre that this thing should be sitting around playing no role when the fish seems to feel pain and swims away from the painful stimulus. The pain feeling is playing no role. So you might worry that the view shares some of the problems of epiphenomenalism as well as some of the problems of interactionism.
I don't think it shares that problem. I mean, first of all, if indeed consciousness is epiphenomenal at kind of lower levels of organic life, fish and so on, then of course it wasn't selected. It couldn't be selected. Things can only be selected if they have influence on behavior. So the selection...
How did it get there if it wasn't selected?
Well, again, the selection has... Okay, let me get a little more specific. Lee Smolin has this theory that universes may replicate themselves through black holes, and so universes are selected to do things like create black holes and have certain kinds of stability that lead to reproduction. Now, some people, and I actually interviewed one of them who's, even as we speak, is on Meaning of Life TV, some people have taken this and suggested, well, maybe intelligent life plays a role in the reproduction. Maybe intelligent beings
create a lot of black holes
through
their technology.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, they can only do that if they get to a technological point where they can create black holes, and they can only get to that point if social organization reaches a level of global cohesion, at least it seems to be. So let me just emphasize, the selection is not taking place at the level of individual organisms as with natural selection. It can't be the case that epiphenomenal consciousness is explained by that. It cannot in principle. The selection is taking place among universes. Some of them have the metaphysical property that life is accompanied by consciousness. And then as the universe matures, those do a better job of replicating. That's an example of the scenario. But a key feature of this is certainly that you're right. The functionality cannot exist at the individual level. The functionality has to exist at the larger social, or even kind of at the level of the whole ecosystem, however you want to look at it. So that's that.
If we had in the background, I mean, this kind of requires a view where consciousness has exactly one causal role, and that's to make us to issue reports about consciousness.
That's not its function.
If we took that as a background premise, that's all consciousness can do and nothing else. I could see how maybe this selection of universe story would then get off the ground. I'm going to say I do find that a kind of weird and maybe in itself a slightly bizarre view of consciousness, that all it does is make us talk about consciousness.
Well, but
I mean,
wait.
If it's the kind of thing which can play a causal role in the physical world and can affect our talking about consciousness, once you've got some mechanism for it to do something, why not suppose it's somewhat more widespread, and that, for example, the pain does in fact help make us withdraw our hand from the flame, that experiencing red might have something to do with what painters do when they paint pictures?
Well, no, but I mean, I don't think it should be so trivialized. I mean, you're saying, wow, it's only to make us issue reports. No, that's not the function. The function is much grander.
Let's distinguish the function, what the telos, what ends up doing for the universe, from the proximal causal role. what it actually does.
Well, right. Well, all kinds of things.
The proximal causal role is affecting.
All kinds of things seem trivial at a microscopic level. It's like, wait, the function of your whole immune system is just so this one cell can eat this other cell? No, but that headed off this disease that would have killed you, okay? At the level of function, it's really important, however trivial a single instance of it seems.
You're going to need an amazing causal mechanism for some non-physical consciousness to get in and affect processes in the brain and start making us talking about it. Somehow you're going to have to solve the problem of the psychophysical nexus. Consciousness yeah. affecting the brain. Once you've got some amazing mechanism
yeah.
which can do that, why on yeah. earth would it just be limited to humans and just be limited to this one little small role of talking about consciousness? If we had a theory of such a mechanism, I'd be inclined to think, boy, well, why not put it to work in a much more widespread way? You know, for example, the pain is making us move away from stimuli. The colors are helping affect our processing of color vision.
I mean, remember,
it's a very limited role for such a massive, wonderful mechanism.
It's a massive role. It saves the damn species, world, and universe, for God's sake. It's a massive role. And I mean, when you say, well, I might have put it to broader use, but remember, if it is a natural selection process, natural selection doesn't think things through like that. It's just like a mutation develops. One universe has this metaphysical dimension. It does better than the rest, and that's the end of the story.
I'm inclined to think that if there is this latent potentiality to play a causal role in the brain, some mechanism sitting around whereby consciousness can somehow affect brains right from the start,
yeah.
evolution ought to find a way to put that to work from the start. Why wait all these years until humans are around, and suddenly in the context of language and culture, oh yeah, well, let's make their lips move and talk about consciousness. But, I mean, surely evolution would find a way to put it to work earlier.
Because the mutation doesn't work that way. I mean, it didn't work that way. And besides, that's not essential at the level of the universe. Life was already doing a fine job of getting to our point in this scenario, and the challenge is getting us beyond it. But let me also say this. I mean, you're right that it would be nice to fill in this gap of, like, what is the mechanism by which an epiphenomenal consciousness leads to a report of it? But that's a problem that afflicts epiphenomenal consciousness to begin with. I mean, this comes closer to saving epiphenomenalism than anything else I've heard.
If consciousness is making us produce the reports, then consciousness is not, strictly speaking, epiphenomenalism.
As I said.
This is not epiphenomenalism. This is interactionism. Consciousness is doing something. And just to be clear, that is your view, right? Consciousness is, in fact, causing the reports? Or is that not your view?
Well, I think it's a hybrid view that, for reasons we don't understand, and look, let's face it, no one has an explanation of consciousness that doesn't involve something we just can't understand. Nobody has a coherent, plausible, comprehensive theory. Okay,
I'm a little bit worried that, like many hybrid views, yeah. they suffer from some aspects of the worst of both worlds.
Well,
like epiphenomenalism, the worry about how it got selected and what it does in these creatures, but then all the more so, like interactionism, the worry about how could it possibly be playing that causal role here in us? How yeah. is consciousness getting in and making us talk about
it? The premise, well, I guess there's one of two premises. The premise I tend to entertain is that there is a threshold that it is, you know, my dog does feel something when he wags his tail, but that feeling doesn't influence anything in his body. And that's the way it is all the way up until you get self-conscious, linguistically proficient organisms. And for reasons we don't understand, but again, there's something we don't understand in all these theories, that once you get to that threshold, there's a kind of a reflectiveness, and maybe it's a kind of a recursive, something metaphysically recursive. You know, actually, you know, one of your mentors was Doug. You worked for Doug Hofstadter. Maybe I should try this out.
Yes,
I should try this out on him, except I think he's in Dennett's camp, so let's not. But anyway, you know, some sort of mechanism kicks in. You know, that's the premise. The other one is the other possibility is the one you sketched out, where it's like on your weird epiphenomenalism planet, where for some reason we don't understand, the evolution naturally leads to the report of consciousness, even though consciousness doesn't do anything. I tend to dismiss that because, look, there are all kinds of reports that would work just as well. You could just say, I insist that you not hit me or I will hit you, period. You know, I don't have to refer to my internal state. I want this in exchange for giving you that. You could work it that way, and it is worked that way sometimes. But so I don't quite go with that. But anyway, this is, I think I've sketched kind of the contour.
If you don't go epiphenomenal, I don't really see then how you've solved what was the biggest problem for any interactionist view all along, which is how on earth does consciousness get in and make a causal difference to, you know, make my mouth move.
Okay.
And so, and given that it sure looks like science is suggesting the brain is a closed system, mm-hmm. and the action of every neuron is determined by the action of the neuron, the mm-hmm. neurons that came before it, and so on. The big problem for any of these views was, how does something non-physical get in and make a difference? And right now, I'm not hearing any proposal about that.
Well, right, but that just dooms epiphenomenalism generally.
Well, this is a problem. I see that as a problem for interactionism, the view that consciousness
plays a critical role. Well, no, it's a problem for
epiphenomenalism.
It's a problem for epiphenomenalism.
Find a mechanism consistent with physics.
It's a problem for epiphenomenalism. There is no plausible scientific Darwinian theory by which these animals evolve and then some of them start saying, I have consciousness.
Let's distinguish the problem for epiphenomenalism, which is how did they evolve, from the problem for interactionism, which is how does consciousness actually get into the brain and play a causal role? I'm understanding your view now as interactionist. Consciousness is playing a causal role, at least in us. Consciousness does affect our brains. And I want to know, how on earth does that happen consistently with physics?
Well, you know, we're at 39 minutes. What I would say is there is this part of the theory that you can't clearly sketch out, right? It's this threshold point where something that has been literally epiphenomenal starts leading to reports about itself. I grant that. And let's move on to your ideas in quantum physics, because I suspect they will illustrate that every theory has this part you can't sketch, right? This part that doesn't make clear sense, that you can't draw out on the chart what's going on here, right?
Can I say one more thing about your theory?
Uh-huh.
Oddly, there's a version of your theory which I can see someone like Dan Dennett quite...
I am abandoning
like
it, but go ahead.
This is the view that, yes, the reason we talk about consciousness so much is that talking about consciousness really did play this big evolutionary role in social cohesion. It was really useful for us to feel as if we had this special property and to talk about it, to isolate us from the rest of nature, distinguish us from the rest of nature. But of course, then the Dennett-style view is going to add the twist. For that evolutionary purpose, there's no reason that consciousness itself needs to exist at all. We're just going to, evolution is going to favor certain self-models where we attribute this property to ourselves to distinguish us and so on. And that explains why it is we have such a strong and vivid intuition that we feel like we have this amazing property consciousness when in fact none of it exists. In fact, I recently did a reverse debate on consciousness with the physicist Carlo Rovelli, where I had to defend the view that consciousness doesn't exist, that consciousness was bullshit in the terms of the debate, and he was having to defend the view that consciousness plays a big role. And I took a version of this view. Consciousness is, the belief that we're conscious was just an evolutionarily selected self-model to make us feel special, but there's no reason to think it actually exists. Now, of course, it's hard to reconcile. The question is whether that does justice to the first-person data. But I can't imagine the Dennett's of the world taking on board much of what you said and just saying, let's forget the consciousness part.
Yeah, he would do that, and that's why it's not a version of my theory, because my theory involves the idea that consciousness is a real thing and that we do actually have feelings and experiences. I mean, also, that would involve a group selection that he wouldn't be drawn to and a bunch of things, but probably. So that's, I wouldn't call that a version, I would call that a warping of my theory, and I would condemn it.
But it does bring out that the key thing in your theory is that talking about consciousness plays this role.
That is when the previously latent functionality becomes manifest, yes.
That's when the Manchurian candidate gets activated.
Well, but again, this happens all the time in designed biological systems.
Yeah.
But I maintain there simply is no... I mean, there's not even a view of what consciousness is that doesn't involve a part that you can't sketch out clearly. And much less a theory of what it does, you know. And in fact, you know, we with epiphenomenalism even, there is the famous water into wine theory. Like, okay, well, let's say the physical being influences the consciousness. Can you sketch that part for me? You know, it's just like, I don't, you know, we don't know. So, but anyway, you're doing work now with a postdoc on having to do with the quantum physics. There's long been this idea. I mean, seems to be finding in quantum physics that the wave function, you know, when an electron is not yet in a definite state, and so it's really just a wave of, you should think of it as a wave of different probabilities of different places it might be, or maybe in a sense different places that it in some sense is, whatever, but it's not a single electron in a single place. It's long been held or known that measuring the system, measuring it, collapses the wave function, at least in some very common views. And so the act of measurement forces the wave function to collapse. And so in a certain sense, measurement encourages the universe to come into definite existence, you might even say. Now, I think, you know, some people are taking this to mean, well, it's the conscious measuring being. It's the physicist who's watching the measuring device, who's bringing the wave function into definite to a specific kind of point. But my view, my impression was that most physicists have abandoned that idea, and they think it's just the physical interaction of the thing with the physical macroscopic measuring device, whether or not a person is there watching, right?
Well, no, I mean, this is kind of at the intersection of two big problems, the problem of consciousness and the problem of interpreting quantum mechanics. The line that I'm pursuing now is really motivated from trying to solve both of those problems and see if they will meet in the middle. Starting from the problem of consciousness, you talked about the water into wine problem. My view has always been that you've got to take consciousness as a kind of a fundamental component of the universe, in the same way we take space and time and mass and charge as fundamental, then consciousness is fundamental too. Once you take something as fundamental, then you don't just abandon theorizing about it. What you try to do is to try and find the laws that govern it. So everyone's going to say maybe there are some laws that say certain physical configurations give you consciousness. But the problem that's especially relevant for us today is the problem, what does consciousness do? What role could it possibly play in physical theory? And most physical theories just look as if the physics part, the space, time, mass, charge, and so on part, is completely closed. Certainly that's what you get on classical Newtonian mechanics or even relativity. What's interesting about quantum mechanics to many people is at least seems to leave open or open a new possibility for how consciousness could get into a physical system. Because in quantum mechanics, at least as classically interpreted, there's two kinds of dynamics. There's the wave function, which moves along according to the Schrodinger equation in a certain fairly straightforward way. But also, every now and then, the wave function undergoes a special kind of change, which is collapse. And then, when and why does collapse happen? Well, according to standard quantum mechanics, it happens on measurement. Next question, what's measurement? That's where people normally throw up their hands. That's the fundamental uninterpreted notion of quantum mechanics. And people call this the measurement problem. What is measurement? How could that play a role in quantum mechanics? And at least one idea that goes back a long way is, here's how we should understand measurement. Measurement is, in fact, the place where consciousness comes in. Measurement is when a physical system affects a conscious observer. Now, you're absolutely right. This view is not especially popular among physicists or even among philosophers of physics these days. One reason why it's not popular is that it's dualistic. It takes consciousness as something fundamental and non-physical. For someone like me, that's not such a problem. I'm already motivated to endorse that kind of view.
But it's also, correct me if I'm wrong, it's also an interactive dualism, not in the traditional Cartesian sense of your consciousness influencing your body, but in the sense of the consciousness in some other sense influencing the physical world, right?
This is a way of having a physically, an interactionist dualism, which unlike Descartes' interactionist dualism, is consistent with physics, where the role for consciousness in the physical world is present right at the basic level of nature, consciousness collapsing wave functions. Now, as I was saying, most physicists reject this, but it's not really because they have better alternatives. I mean, there's a graphite, some people try and do without collapse of the wave function altogether, so-called many worlds views or hidden variables views. You probably don't have time to explore those, but they all have problems. But if you try to hold on to the basic idea, there's a special kind of interaction called measurement that collapses the wave function. No one knows how to draw that line. You can't just say that's when it's big enough or it's complex enough. Some people try to do it by decoherence in macroscopic systems, but that just leads to a version of the many worlds interpretation. So anyway, long story short there is there's at least a possible kind of view, the consciousness collapses the wave function, that has been, once upon a time was popular, is now widely dismissed, but which I think has not been seriously explored, has not been well enough explored. What I'm trying to do in my work with Kelvin McQueen, who is currently a postdoc, well, he's just moved from being a postdoc at Tel Aviv to being tenure track now at Chapman University after working on a PhD with me at ANU. What we're seeing, if we can take that old idea and actually make it mathematically rigorous, that consciousness could somehow exert a causal effect on the dynamics of the wave function, so that when there is consciousness, the wave function collapses into a definite state. One idea we have is that consciousness is special and unlike regular physical properties in that it never enters into quantum superpositions. Space.
Wait. You're saying consciousness never enters into quantum superposition.
So an electron in quantum mechanics can be, you know, needn't be in a definite position here or a definite position there. It's standardly thought of as being in a wave function in which it's in all these positions at once.
Right.
This wave specifies a superposition of all these positions. And any physical property, it seems, can enter a superposition. But here's a hypothesis. Consciousness is special. Consciousness never enters a superposition. It's always in a definite state. You know, what would a superposed consciousness be like?
Well, what would a consciousness in a definite state be like? I mean, you know, it's just hard to conceive of in general.
Okay, well, let's take this hypothesis at face value. And now the thought is, whenever a superposed physical system affects a conscious being, mm-hmm. then, well, if the whole system kept evolving according to Schrodinger dynamics, the brain would have to go into a superposition of, you know, seeing the particle there and seeing the particle there, and you'd get two different consciousnesses, or a superposition of two different consciousnesses, seeing the particle there and seeing the particle there. Ah, that can't happen, though. Consciousness is constrained to always stay in a definite state. So somehow this forces the brain, consciousness is entangled with the brain, in quantum mechanical terms, so the brain is forced to go into a definite state, that's a collapse, and thereby everything in the physical world which is entangled with that brain, just by the standard mathematics of quantum mechanics, will now collapse. So the thought is, if you spell out this story in the right mathematical terms, it starts to look as the point where consciousness comes into the process is also the point where things collapse. Consciousness goes into a definite state, this puts the brain into a definite state. This will ultimately lead to certain definite consequences, including, among other things, if my consciousness goes into the state of seeing the particle there rather than there, this will cause the brain to collapse into a neural state, which causes the report, mm-hmm. I'm seeing the particle there rather than there. So there's a potential causal role for consciousness in driving verbal reports. This is the point where maybe we could combine this with your theory for an unholy hybrid that does everything.
Well, it certainly has some... It faces some challenges in common with my theory.
It's a long shot.
I mean, like, for example...
Speculation and a long shot.
Right. Like, so when you said consciousness somehow influences the wave function, well, the word somehow kind of reminded me of, you know, somehow once you get to self-conscious beings, a previously latent and epiphenomenal consciousness starts exerting influence on the world. And of course, in both of them, in both cases, you say, well, wait, what do you mean somehow? Sketch it out. And in both cases, you know, it's almost, even if I hadn't told, you know, hadn't assumed epiphenomenalism up to that point, I would still face the problem you face, which is the wine into water problem, not the water into wine problem, but the wine into water problem. Just imagining, conceiving, articulating what it would be like for this thing called consciousness to influence the physical world. And I don't think anybody...
Well, my view, it's a simple, straightforward, fundamental law. Everywhere in physics, some things are taken as fundamental. Some properties, like space and time and mass.
Yeah.
Some laws, like, say, the law of gravitation. People said to Newton, how does it happen that these two massive properties exert this force on each other. He said, well, that's, some things have to be taken as fundamental. In my view, consciousness is fundamental. No. So certain laws, certain principles involving it are also fundamental. And here, that'll be the constraint that consciousness can't be superposed is a fundamental principle. And the effect that will have on the fundamental dynamics is the moment any physical system potentially becomes entangled with consciousness by that law of consciousness, it too will have to go into a definite state. So I think you can actually make the mathematical dynamics fairly straightforward. There are some, there are a few problems there. But once one does that, the basic principle here is just that's taken as fundamental. And the thought is, it's okay to take some things as fundamental in your theory as long as they're simple enough. And our hope is this might be simple enough.
Okay. I mean, I would say even in Newton's case, he says, well, you just have to accept these two things exert a force on each other. Actually, Einstein said, I'm not willing to accept that. And he came up with a system which had its own hard-to-imagine things, but it did simplify the gravity problem in the sense of depicting it as stuff just kind of rolling along a space-time landscape of a space-time continuum or something. Anyway, Einstein felt he had taken the spookiness out of gravity. So it is, you know, it's not unreasonable to demand that when somebody says, wait, just accept it as fundamental, you say, no, I would like something more. I mean,
fair enough. And if someone wants to come up with a successor, maybe the way is open to come up with a successor theory, which is even simpler. But at least by my lights, I think, you know, if you can state some fairly simple mathematical equations, namely probabilistic, even if they're probabilistic, to get the dynamics right and explain the data, then that's at least a candidate.
So the premise is kind of that there's something about consciousness. Well, it's almost like it's, I don't want to say inherently monolithic, but it resists, well, maybe you could say that, right? It resists fragmentation.
Resists superposition.
It's a substance that will not put up with the uncertainty of quantum physics. And so it's like, in order to render the world intelligible to it, is that another way of saying that? In order to render the world intelligible to it, it insists that the electron, that the wave simplify itself.
Well, this is really anthropomorphizing consciousness now, which is...
Well, that's if there's anything you should be able to anthropomorphize.
If anything, then... So, yeah, you might think somewhat more down-to-earth way to put it is that consciousness by its very nature can't be superposed. It's, you know, we can't even conceive a superposed consciousness. It's the kind of thing which, by its very nature, is always in a definite state. And if that's too strong for you, let's just take it as a fundamental constraint, fundamental law of nature. Consciousness happens to resist superposition. There are some stories you can tell about why it would have to be that way. But if it turns out to merely be a fundamental law, consciousness resists superposition, that would be good enough for me.
Well, I think if you're allowed to call that a fundamental law, I should be allowed to say it's a fundamental law that epiphenomenal consciousness begins to influence the world once a being becomes self-conscious and linguistically proficient. But in any event,
maybe that calls out for explanation.
In any event. So you could take this, I mean, this reminds me in a very distant way of certain kind of mystical views of the world, which is that consciousness is inherently unified, and even the seeming independence of our own spheres of consciousness is a kind of illusion, right? So that I mean, that on the one hand, that's a very different type of claim, but it has in common with your view the idea that the natural and true state of consciousness is indivisible.
The way I was thinking about this view, there are many different spheres of consciousness, all of which could be independently collapsing the wave function, mine and yours, and maybe even a dog's or a fish's, could all be collapsing the wave function. There could be version. There's another kind of view where there's just a universal collective consciousness, maybe that underlies all of reality. I entertain that kind of idea in different speculative moods. I'm not really sure how you'd go about combining that view with this view of consciousness collapsing the wave function. Maybe a single universal consciousness is like God's consciousness, is always looking down and collapsing the wave function, and we're all components of that consciousness. To me, that would complicate the view. There is an idea that some people have taken seriously in different contexts. You know, Berkeley, the great idealist, thought that we're all components basically of the mind of the physical world, all exist within the mind of God. People are now reviving that kind of view, sometimes without the God. Well, so that's a different direction.
Couple of questions. So it is your view, I take it, that it isn't just when quantum physicists are using these instruments to measure electrons that consciousness plays a kind of causal role in some sense, but when animals are just viewing the world. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I mean, this view is can be combined with different views about what the threshold of consciousness is. I mean, you're going to need a theory of where consciousness kicks in, and then the claim is going to be whenever that happens, that's when wave function collapse happens. So if consciousness kicks in fish, then fish, every time a fish makes an observation, that will collapse the wave function. If consciousness kicks in at the cell level, which is possible, cells collapse the wave function. If it kicks in at the level of humans, then only humans collapse the wave function. I'm inclined to think consciousness goes a long way down the natural order, and so does wave function collapse. But there'll be nothing special about measuring instruments. What's going to be special is where, in fact, consciousness arises.
Mm-hmm. And second question, so is this an example? You know, I've heard the phrase, the ontological primacy of consciousness, which means consciousness is more fundamental in the physical world. I've heard it in the context of like Asian Indian philosophy or so on. There are kind of somewhat, I guess, Buddhist versions of it maybe and Hindu versions of it. But is this an example of that?
I would say no, because this is still a version of dualism. It says there's the physical world and there's consciousness. They're separate, but they interact.
Mm-hmm.
I think of the Buddhist view as more a version of what philosophers call idealism, which is there's only consciousness and the physical world comes from that. It's the flip side of materialism, which says there's only physics and consciousness.
And the Western version of that is Berkeley and the Western idealists.
Another version which has been popular lately is panpsychism.
Right.
There's consciousness in every particle throughout the universe, and the interactions of all those give us the physical world. So it's an idea which I think is very much, which is worth taking seriously, again, in very speculative moods. But it's a different idea from this view where only there's physics and there's consciousness and they interact. If it turns out that if everything was consciousness, then this view couldn't work, because consciousness, wherever it's present, collapses the wave function. And we know that wave functions don't always collapse. Photons will give us interference effects in a double slit experiment. If photons were conscious too, they would collapse the wave function. You wouldn't get the interference effect. So for this theory to work, we need some bits of the world that don't have consciousness and that don't collapse the wave function. So it's probably actually inconsistent with that.
Of course, panpsychism doesn't tell us what consciousness is for, right? It's just a theory that it's been there even in the prebiotic world.
No, yeah, that's right. Although it's very naturally combined with a view where certain physical entities, maybe even certain physical properties, essentially involve consciousness. You know, maybe mass, what we call mass. We really understand it by the role that it plays in physical theory. Maybe that's actually consciousness playing a role there in physical theory. On panpsychism, the physical world is itself a whole bunch of connections among the conscious properties of little entities. So that's naturally associated with a view of the causal role of at least microconsciousness. The role of mass is to resist acceleration and to induce gravitation. So the role of consciousness might be to do that as well. How that connects to the roles it plays in us, no one really understands. But if you wanted to speculate in that direction, you could combine combine panpsychism with a causal role for consciousness at the very microscopic level.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's all very mysterious. I think I would emphasize that what we kind of alluded to earlier, it's like, it seems to be the thing that gives life meaning, and it seems to be something that no one has a clear and satisfactory explanation for. And that in itself is just very philosophically interesting to me, and, you know, calls for a certain amount of humility. I mean, that's just pretty amazing. I mean, we're like a long way from getting the picture, it seems to me.
Consciousness is, look, it's the most remarkable thing in the world, but it's also, you know, the most absolutely familiar thing in the world. And it is a little remarkable we've gotten so far with our build-up of a coherent scientific worldview, while still having something so central be so mysterious. Okay, this is something that's making my life interesting and your life interesting to think about, but I'm still always often inclined to think that, you know, in 500 years, once we finally figured it out, we'll probably look back at where we are now and say they were still struggling in the dark.
Right. And it's far from clear. I mean, science has also, well, they've just made, this is kind of what you're saying, but they've gotten very far along in explaining the world, including the behavior of organisms, without making reference to a causal role for consciousness, although I do think it gets challenging when you start talking about animals who are talking about how they feel. That becomes challenging, and that's the challenge I'm trying to address.
There's an awful lot we don't understand even about behavior and complex cognition, of course, of animals and of human beings. And it's also interesting that science has gotten as far as it's gotten largely by kicking out consciousness out of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Galileo and Newton and so on managed to build their sciences of the physical world by kicking things like colors and those subjective qualities into the mind and saying, let's worry about that later. And then the study of the mind, even the study of the brain, has gotten a long way while kicking the problem of consciousness into let's worry about that later. But at some later point, we're going to actually have to do the worrying. And
well, I'd say two things. I mean, one is you can talk about the physical prerequisites for the apprehension of color, the wavelength of the lights that bounce off the tree leaf and so on, but and even why they bounce off and why other ones are absorbed by the tree leaf. But there's that. But the other thing I'd say is, you know, this is also fascinating to me, is, you know, consciousness resists study by virtue of the ground rules of science. Phenomena that science studies are supposed to be publicly observable, where you and I can look at them, we can measure them independently, compare our notes, whereas my consciousness cannot be observed by anyone but me. So
we can at least measure our own consciousness, which you might think is kind of like two physicists can at least make measurements on their own oscilloscope. It's not like they have to crowd.
Well, yeah, but they're measuring the same thing with the oscilloscope. They're not measuring the same thing when they report on their own consciousness. And it's a private experience, and scientifically investigable phenomena are supposed to be publicly observable.
But it's true that it is very difficult to measure. The way this works, there is, though, at the same time, a robust science of consciousness these days, which is exciting.
Yeah,
and the way it works is basically we treat it as if we do have at least one measuring instrument. That's the measuring instrument of our own introspection and our own verbal report.
Right.
So if someone says, I'm feeling an intense pain, then you take that as reason to think they are feeling intense
pain. Right, but that's an assumption. That's an assumption, strictly speaking.
All scientists have to make assumptions.
Yeah, but the only publicly observable part of that is the report, what comes out of their lips. It remains the fact that the consciousness is not publicly observable. It's just qualitatively different, I'm sorry, as you know, from all the other stuff.
But let's think about what goes on in the rest of science, where, you know, I have the experience that an oscilloscope needle is moving a certain way. Well, how do I know the oscilloscope needle is moving that way? All I've really observed is my own experience. We make an assumption that when my experience is doing this, there's something in the physical world.
But
that
you can line up.
No one can prove that. And skeptics can raise all the doubts that they want about whether the external world exists. We make that assumption. Here's how science works. We make that assumption, and we see where it leads. And it leads to a coherent theory. And it's great. So I think, likewise, in the science of consciousness, we need to make a starting assumption those verbal reports accurately reflect consciousness. Then we can build a science on that.
Okay, but it's a different assumption, is all I'm saying.
I agree.
I mean, if you're wondering whether what you see in the oscilloscope is a hallucination, you can line up five other people and compare notes, and that at least reduces the chances that it's an hallucination. Again, consciousness is private. It's the only thing that's inherently private, and it's a thing that gives life meaning. And
that makes it super important and super problematic. I agree, but
I think
it doesn't rule out building a science of it, and people are finding ways to at least make limited progress on the science of consciousness, despite those problems.
Well, I think
it's very early days yet.
I certainly think the philosophy of consciousness can be informed by science, whether there can ever
and
be.
It has been a great deal.
Yeah, I agree
20,
on that.
25 years.
So we close on a note of concord. It's super weird and super important.
And super interesting and super fun to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe we'll do this again sometime when after we both dreamed up even wackier theories.
By the way, if anyone wants to see those very wacky ideas about consciousness and the collapse of the wave function, there's a video on YouTube of my giving a talk about this. Just search for consciousness and the collapse of the wave function. You'll find a few more details there, although no doubt still plenty to disagree with.
And we will link to that as well on the site. So it'll accompany this video. Is there anything else we should link to?
Oh, the reverse debate I mentioned with Carlo Rovelli. That recently went online from the FQXI conference. Just search for reverse debate on consciousness. That's only about 5 minutes and kind of fun.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, David. I'll let you get back to thinking about your thinking and your feeling and so on.
Thanks. It was fun.
Yep. Take care.